Yesterday, we heard of Arjuna's doubts and his reasons for not wishing to fight. They were strong reasons. They were logical. They were shastri. They were compassionate. But they were all wrong. Now, at the end of page 7 of the overview book, we've summarized these reasons and divided them into five basic categories. The first was compassion. Arjuna's compassion for those that he was about to slay dictated that he should not fight. He was thinking that those whom he loved would have to be killed. He did not want that. He was compassionate. The second one was not quite as noble, but enjoyment. Arjuna thinks that he would not be able to enjoy his kingdom if the kingdom is won at the cost of the lives of his family members. As Arjuna said, that everything will be tainted by blood. How could I enjoy my kingdom if those people who I would have to enjoy with will be dead by my own hand? I cannot enjoy, therefore I shouldn't fight. Third, destruction of the family. Irreligion and unwanted progeny will overcome the family. Performance of traditional vanashrama-oriented Vedic rituals be ended, and hell will await both the family and the destroyer of the family. So there's actually two reasons in one here. And the second one is the second part of this one is actually into the fourth reason of sinful reactions. But in destruction of the family, practically speaking, tradition is passed on through the medium of the family. And tradition is essential for the passing on culture. And this Vedic culture, whose purpose is not mundane sense gratification, but it's spiritual elevation, that very culture will be stopped if such a battle is fought. Therefore, Arjuna is thinking we should not fight. Family will be destroyed. The elders will be destroyed. The women will be unprotected. Vanasankara will be propagated throughout the world just on account of this one battle. It's not worth it. We shall not fight. And then four sinful reactions. Arjuna thought enjoying royal happiness, which is temporary and within this life only, is not worth the resulting sinful reactions for destroying the family and killing his superiors. He's going to have to suffer for thousands and thousands of births, for all the sins he's going to commit in this one battle. To gain a kingdom on earth, is it worth it? No. And finally, indecision. Arjuna thought that he did not actually know which was better, conquering the Kurus or being conquered by them. So for these basic reasons, which are explained by Arjuna in the last half of the first chapter and the first half of the second chapter, Arjuna has decided that he will not fight. Now, text 7, we were up to, is a very important verse. Now I am confused about my duty, and I have lost all composure because of miserly weakness. In this condition, I am asking you to tell me for certain what is best for me. Now I am your disciple and a soul surrendered unto you. Please instruct me. So Arjuna had so many logical, shastric, compassionate, good-hearted, motive goodness reasons for not wishing to fight. And the result of all his reasoning was simply that he was confused. And therefore, he did the proper thing. Shishyashteham sarimam tvam prapanam. He surrendered unto his guru, Krishna. Prabhupada explains in the purport that this situation, wherein one becomes confused despite all his endeavors to make a solution to all his problems, This situation of confusion is not limited to Arjuna. Rather, it is every man's situation. And why? Prabhupada explains. By nature's own way, the complete system of material activities is a source of perplexity for everyone. In every step there is perplexity. And therefore it behooves one to approach a bona fide spiritual master who can give one proper guidance for executing the purpose of life. All Vedic literatures advise us to approach a bona fide spiritual master and get free from the perplexities of life, which happen without our desire. They are like a forest fire that somehow blazes without being set by anyone. Similarly, the world situation is such that perplexities of life automatically appear without our wanting such confusion. No one wants fire, and yet it takes place, and we become perplexed. The Vedic wisdom therefore advises that in order to solve the perplexities of life and to understand the science of the solution, one must approach a spiritual master who is in the disciplic succession. A person with a bona fide spiritual master is supposed to know everything. One should not therefore remain in material perplexities, but one should approach a spiritual master. This is the purport of this verse. So Arjuna surrenders to Krishna. So naturally, we would expect, if Arjuna is surrendering to Krishna in text 7, then text 8, Krishna should immediately start instructing him. But Krishna doesn't immediately start instructing him. Arjuna speaks again. And the acharyas fill in the reason for this. And they say that Krishna replies to Arjuna. Arjuna says, I am perplexed, I am confused, I want to surrender to you. And Krishna's reply is, you need a guru, and I'm your friend. Why surrender to me? And anyway, your problem, you don't need a guru to solve it. You don't need that, Arjuna. All you need to do, your duty is fight. And if you win, you win your kingdom, and then all your problems will be solved. You don't need a guru. Just fight and take your kingdom. Be successful. And then Arjuna's reply to that testing of Krishna is text 8. I can find no means to drive away this grief, which is drying up my senses. I will not be able to dispel it, even if I win a prosperous, unrivaled kingdom on earth, with sovereignty like the demigods in heaven.
This internal discussion is far away.
It's in the... Sometimes Prabhupada includes it in his purports, but these... The acharyas like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and Baladeva Vidyabhusana, they connect the verses by explaining the inner thoughts of Krishna and Arjuna. So in their commentaries, and Prabhupada often includes them in his verses and purports. Text 9. Sanjay said, having spoken thus, Arjuna, chastiser of enemies, told Krishna, Govinda, I shall not fight, and fell silent. Now, Arjuna calls Krishna Rishikesh, which means the master of the senses. So by this naming of Krishna as Rishikesh, it is to be understood that Arjuna is saying, you are the master of my senses, and because you want me to fight, I am going to fight. But in any case, for the time being, I'm not going to fight, even though I know by your order I will fight. You are my master. Now Krishna, in the next verse, he does something interesting, as Sanjay explains. O descendant of Bharata, at that time Krishna, smiling in the midst of both the armies, spoke the following words to the grief-stricken Arjuna. Now the word used for smiling is prahasan. It's like smiling. Because Krishna, Prabhupada explains in the purport, that Krishna, he's smiling, he's happy, because his friend Arjuna is becoming his disciple, Arjuna. And his smiling changes gradually to a very grave expression on his face, because he is now going to act not as friend, but as spiritual master. And the talks between spiritual master and disciple are very serious. So therefore, Krishna's prahasan, like smiling, it's called rasa sandhi, or a changing, or a meeting of two different rasas. The friendship rasa, in this verse, meets with parental rasa, vatsalya rasa, where Krishna, where the guru and disciple, which is similar to the guru-disciple relationship. So Krishna's smile is prahasan, it's like smiling, it's half smiling, turning to gravity. And this is actually explained by Prabhupada in the purport. And towards the end of the purport, Prabhupada explains, it appears that the talk between the master and the disciple was openly exchanged in the presence of both armies, so that all were benefited. So the talks of Bhagavad Gita are not for any particular person, society or community, but they are for all, and friends or enemies are equally entitled to hear them. Because now Krishna is going to give his instructions, and they are not just meant for Arjuna, they are meant for everyone, each and every one of us, and everyone else as well. Now Krishna begins to speak. Asochan anvasochas tam. Asochan means you are lamenting. Asochan, you are lamenting that which is not worthy of lamentation. Asochan anvasochas tvam, you are lamenting that which is not lamentable. Pragyavaram, Srivasa say. You are speaking very learned words and you have given so many learned shastric logical arguments why you should not fight, but still you are lamenting which is for that which is not worthy to be lamented. Gatasu na gatasum cha, for neither the living nor the dead. Nanu sochanti pandita. The wise person laments, the pandit laments. So therefore, Krishna begins his instructions by saying you are speaking as if you were a wise man. But wise people don't say what you're saying. Therefore, another slap. You're a fool. Pretentious and a fool. Now listen, and you'll learn something. It's also interesting to note that Arjuna's education, like most of our educations, begins with an A. A, B, C, but this one begins with an A. Asochan, like all good education. And this begins the section B over here of the chapter. What I'd like to do now is just go through very, very quickly, the sections of this chapter. Because this is the Bhagavad Gita overview. And what we're trying to do is give everyone an idea of how the chapters work as a unit and how they connect to the next chapter. So the first section, section A, is an introduction. Now later on, hopefully I'll give you some of these summary sheets. The second section which we're going to enter now is jnana. I'm trying to make our labeling of these sections quite simple so that they're easy to memorize. Now in this chapter we're going to use more or less all Sanskrit terms and they'll be explained as we go along. I'm sure all of you know what jnana is. Bolo? Knowledge. And what knowledge specifically? Is it geography? History? Sankhya? What? Transcendental knowledge. But specifically knowledge of the difference between the soul and the body. And that's exactly what Krishna speaks of in the second section, which goes from 11 to 30. I think that's clearly listed on your sheet. Now the third section, after explaining about jnana, that we're not our body, Krishna does something very interesting. He explains sakama. Sakama. Sakam karma. We'll just call it sakama, which means with desires. Krishna explains in the second section that Arjuna, if he fights, his desires will be satisfied. Because if he wins, he'll have the kingdom on earth. And if he loses, he'll go to heaven. And on the other hand, if he doesn't fight, If he doesn't fight, he will gain nothing good. He will gain sin by neglecting his duty, and he will gain infamy, and people will criticize him. Sakama, with desires. This isn't the way we generally preach, that people should do their duty to get material rewards, not to devotees anyway. But Krishna explains this. This is sakama, sakam karma, or working with kam, or desires. Section D explains Buddhi Yoga. Now, Buddhi Yoga is very interesting. Another term for this type of Buddhi Yoga is Nishkam Karma. Now, this isn't a term found in our Bhagavad Gita as it is, but it's one used by the Acharyas, and the use of this term makes several distinctions easy. Nishkam Karma, I'll write it up here. As Sakam Karma means with desires, Nishkam means without, working without any material desires. And Nishkam Karma is described here as Buddhi Yoga in this section. And this Buddhi Yoga, very interestingly, is a combination of knowledge and karma, or work. Working with knowledge. It's a combination of jnana and karma. And that's Buddhi Yoga. And the last section, section E, is basically a section describing the result of working in Buddhi Yoga. And what is that result? It's samadhi. Or one is fixed, consciousness is fixed on the absolute truth. So that the way the chapter fits together is after the introduction over here, Krishna explains that we're not the body. Then he explains, on one hand, working with material desires. Then what he really wants to explain is this one over here, Buddhi Yoga, or working without material desires, dutifully working. And then the result of that Buddhi Yoga is samadhi, or being fixed in the absolute truth. Now, one other very important introductory point that Prabhupada, in his purports, and we'll see it later, where Buddhi Yoga is used, he always defines it as Krishna consciousness, because there's a difference. There's two ways to look at Nishkam Karma. Who remembers what Nishkam Karma is?
Working without.
Okay, might as well all say it at once. Working without material desires. Sakam, working with material desires. And Buddhi Yoga, Buddhi means intelligence. So when one is using his intelligence, he's working, but not with his mind being fixed on the sense objects, but his intelligence is fixed in jnana, then he's working detached because he knows that he's a soul and not his body. Now, Prabhupada explains Nishkam Karma, or Buddhi Yoga, is working in Krishna consciousness because there is a gradual process on the yoga ladder, which we'll be describing throughout the first six chapters. There's a gradual process where one first becomes detached, and one then one understands that he's not his body, and then one, after understanding he's not his body, understands that he's a spirit soul, and then he understands that not only is he a spirit soul, but there's a supreme spirit soul, and then he surrenders to the supreme spirit soul, and then he finds out that that supreme spirit soul is Krishna, the supreme personality of Godhead, not only the super soul. That's the yoga ladder, and we'll be describing that in detail. And what the glory of Bhakti Yoga is that all these stages, from the bottom stage to the top stage, if one takes the Bhakti, one can fix his mind on Krishna right from the very beginning and gradually get detached, get knowledge, and gradually come to the lotus feet of Krishna fully realized. So Bhakti Yoga, as the ultimate goal of yoga, is how Prabhupada defines Buddhi Yoga here, because this is actually and ultimately what Krishna wants. Now, That's some of the things that go on in the second chapter, and we're going to go through it now. And by the end of the second chapter, Arjuna is confused. So similarly, at the end of the second chapter, you will all be confused. Because the second chapter is called The Contents of the Bhagavad Gita Summarized, and more or less everything is in here, and it's not presented in an extremely systematic way. And therefore, we'll do chapter 2. After that, we'll do 3, 4, 5, 6, and gradually it'll be all unraveled. So don't get discouraged if it's not completely clear at this point. These terms will take some getting used to, but still memorize the sections. And when we finish the second chapter, we'll probably have a quiz on it. And you'll just have to be able to memorize these simple sections and know what they mean and understand how they connect to them very well. And more important than doing well on the quiz, you'll understand the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Okay, let's go on. Krishna immediately... Yeah, question.
Bhakti-yoga is equal to bhakti-yoga when one reaches the
When one focuses his mind on Krishna,
yes,
and he's detached from his from the fruits of his work, and he's focusing his mind on Krishna, it's called Krishna consciousness or bhakti-yoga. He's doing his work for Krishna. But when one is just detached from the fruit of his work, it's called nishkam karma. But if one is detached from the fruit of his work and offering it to Krishna, it's called bhakti yoga. Yeah, right. But buddhi yoga can also mean nishkam karma, and bhakti yoga and nishkam karma are the same thing. But buddhi yoga can also mean just detachment from the fruit of the work by understanding that you're not your body. And therefore you detach. And that's what is recommended, basically.
What does the word buddhi mean?
Intelligence.
Buddhi yoga means combination of karma and jnana?
Yeah. Karma meaning work in knowledge. And the highest knowledge is knowledge of Krishna. Now Krishna is very tricky. He's going to be very tricky. And his trickiness is exposed in the first 6 chapters, because he speaks on many different levels at the same time according to the what the person wants. If you want to practice Jnana Yoga and go to Brahman, the instructions are in here how to do it. And the same verses that will bring you to Brahman, if you have the understanding of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, will bring you to the lotus feet of Krishna. So depending upon what you want, that's what you'll get. And Prabhupada, and we'll, the point will come up later, Prabhupada very clearly tells us what we should want in the purports by defining buddhi yoga as Krishna consciousness, by defining karma yoga as Krishna consciousness. He gives us, right from the very beginning, the most confidential knowledge and doesn't take us through all the steps that Krishna actually proposes. He knows the mind of Krishna, so he actually tells us, Sarvadamam Prityaja Mame Kam Sharanam Braja. He gives us the conclusion from the first chapters on. Okay, we'll not spoil all the fun as it unravels, and let's go on. So Krishna has said, first chastise Arjuna, while speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor the dead. So Krishna, that's his prelude to explaining that Arjuna nor all the other people on the battlefield are their bodies. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So Krishna is saying, in the past I was Krishna, in the present I am Krishna, and in the future I will be Krishna. In the past you were Arjuna, in the present you're Arjuna, in the future, you will be Arjuna. And all these kings in the assembled, they are individuals. In the past, they were individuals. In the present, they are individuals. And also in the future, they will be individuals. So, here in this verse, as Krishna is beginning to explain that we are not our bodies, our souls, he's also defeating Mayavad philosophy. Because he is identifying right from the very beginning that he is an individual, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and Arjuna is an individual, and each and every one of the kings are also individuals. And if someone thinks that Krishna doesn't say in the future, everyone will become me, I'm the Supreme Lord, he doesn't say that at all. Or in the past, I was formless, in the present I am Krishna, and in the future I'll again be formless. He doesn't say that at all. He says, I was Krishna, I am Krishna, I will be Krishna. He doesn't say, Arjuna, in the past you were merged into me, and then right now, due to being covered by illusion somehow or another, you have become you, and in the future, after removing the illusion, you will again become one with me. He doesn't speak like that at all. He's stressing individuality here. And if the individuality only had to do with the body, why would he stress his own individuality even? Because Krishna is not his body. Krishna is his body, rather. Krishna is not, doesn't have a material body. Angani yasya sakalendriya vrittimanti. He has a spiritual body. So it's not that if one is spiritual, one isn't an individual. And if they say, well, Krishna is just in a material body, which is wrong, but if that's said, then why are they reading the Bhagavad Gita at all? This is the logic that Prabhupada gives in the purport. Text 13. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. The self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. So here, Arjuna was worried. What was he worried about? Bhishma, Drona were right before him. He's worried that he's going to have to kill them. He's going to force them to die. So Krishna tells them they cannot die because they are souls. And you're worried, and death, what is death anyway? It's just a change of bodies. And this type of change of body isn't so rare, because at one time Bhishma was a young boy, Komaram, and one time he was a youth, Jovanam, and then now he's an old man, Jara. So he's gone through so many different changes of body, and the same with Drona and everyone else. Dhiras tatra namuyate. And the wise person is not bewildered by these changes of body. So death is just another change of body. So stop your lamentation, Arjuna. It is based on illusion. And anyway, remember the story of Jayati? Maharaj Jayati, he was an old man. He had his youth. And then he gave it up and he became old. But then when he got a new body, was everyone happy? When he got back his young body, was everyone happy or was everyone sad? When Jayati had an old body and was begging all of his sons, Yadu, Pandu, this one and that one, please give me my young body back. Give me your youth in exchange for my old age. You know that story? And then, when he became young and had a young body again, everyone didn't lament. They were very happy. So Krishna is telling Arjuna, so why will you lament if Bhishma and Drona take on a new young body again? Don't lament. Dhiras tatra namuyate. Don't be intoxicated. So Arjuna's reply to that is yes, it will be good for them and change their bodies because my relationship is with their body. It'll be so difficult. I'll be miserable. And what's Krishna's reply to that? The next verse. Matra sparsha stakanteya sitos na suka dugadaha. Agamapayano anityas tamstitikshasvabharata. Krishna's reply is, O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, O Sian, Sayan of Bharata, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. So Krishna's instructions to Arjuna about this point, that he's going to be very much miserable if Bhishma and Drona change their bodies, is yes, but you must be tolerant. O best amongst men, The person who is not disturbed by happiness or distress and is steady in both is certainly eligible for liberation. So that means that if one acts, karma, does his karma or work, but steadily, not disturbed by happiness and distress, based on the gyan, this basic gyan, what is the result? Liberation. So this is a basic principle that we'll be discussing more, but it's mentioned quickly here in the Bhagavad Gita, as Krishna quickly also goes on in his instructions. Those who are the seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, which is the material body, there is no endurance. And of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. So those who are seers, those who know the truth, the darshabi, this is another slap, by the way, because Arjuna is lamenting, and Krishna is saying, those who are seers, not like you, because you're lamenting, but those who are seers of the truth have concluded this, that this material body is temporary, and practically speaking, it doesn't exist. Because you close your eyes, and you open it, and that body has changed. And you close your eyes for 5 years, and I look at you, and I won't even recognize you, because your body has changed in every way. So it doesn't exist. Even 1 second, the body has changed. So practically, it doesn't exist. And the soul is eternal. So those things that change, this verse explains in a very analytical way, those things that change, they don't exist. And those things that never change, they are eternal and they have actual existence. Now to explain this point that existence means eternality and non-existence means temporality, Krishna explains the next two verses over here. There are two points in the first part of the first verse, na sato vidite bhavo, na bhavo vidite sata, that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no, or the temporary, there is no existence. And the second point is those things that exist, the sata, the eternal, they are always enduring, and they truly exist. So to explain the true eternal existence of something that does exist, Krishna explains 17, that which pervades the entire body, you should know it to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy that imperishable soul. And then to explain the other point about the material body being temporary and not factually existing, Krishna explains text 18, the material body of the indestructible, immeasurable, and eternal living entity is sure to come to an end. And based on this jnana, what does Krishna say? Therefore fight, O descendant of Bharata. Now, Arjuna has put forward logic on compassion, that I shouldn't fight because I'm going to be killing these dearly beloved people. And here, Krishna has attacked and defeated that argument that there is no question of killing them because they are eternal. And not only that, not only is there no question of killing an eternal soul, Krishna speaks 19, neither he who thinks the living entity the slayer, nor he who thinks it slain is in knowledge, for the self slays not, nor is slain. So if you are thinking, I am the slayer, if you are thinking you are the subject or the actor, I am the slayer, then that is not knowledge. Or if you are thinking that someone is being slain, that the object is being slain, that is also not knowledge, for the self slays not, nor is slain. No one can be the killer, because no one can be killed. For the soul, there is neither birth nor death at any time. He does not come into being and will not come into being. In the past, he didn't come into being. In the present, he didn't come into being. In the future, he will not come into being. He is unborn, eternal, ever existing and primeval, he is not slain when the body is slain. All gyan, knowledge, the difference between the soul and the body. O Partha, how can a person who knows that the soul is indestructible, eternal, unborn, and immutable, kill anyone or cause anyone to kill? Okay, Arjuna says, the soul is eternal. I'll not kill anybody, but I'll be the cause of their changing bodies. That's a fact, isn't it, Krishna? So I don't want to be the cause of anyone's changing their bodies. You're saying that I can't kill them. Okay, granted, I'll use your gyan. But I also don't want to be the cause of anyone's changing their bodies. Why should they have to change their body? Let me not fight, and they won't change their body. Therefore, Krishna replies that you can't stop this change of body by your not fighting. As a person puts on new garments, giving up old ones, the soul similarly accepts new bodies, giving up the old and useless ones. So he says, this is inevitable. By your not fighting, you're not going to stop the change of bodies of your beloved Bhishma and Drona and all the other relatives that are now standing before you on the battlefield. Therefore, fight. 23. The soul can never be cut to pieces by any weapon. Now, what are some of Arjuna's weapons that they use? He's got a sword. Well, the sword cannot cut the soul to any weapon, nor burned by fire. They also had fire weapons. Nor moistened by water. They also had water weapons. Nor withered by the wind. And they had wind weapons. So in this way, all the weapons that Arjuna is carrying are not going to cut, burn, dry, or wither the eternal soul. This individual soul is unbreakable and insoluble. It can neither be burned nor dried. He is everlasting, present everywhere, unchangeable, immovable, and eternally the same. It is said that the soul is invisible, inconceivable, and immutable. Knowing this, you should not grieve for the body. Now, in the next verse, in 26, the first words, atatcha. Atatcha means, if however. That means that the topic is going to be changed over here. So Krishna has explained that the weapons that Arjuna is holding in his hand, he's put them down actually because he's decided not to fight superficially. Krishna is explaining they cannot hurt the soul. But now Krishna is going to change his argument. He's saying fight because you cannot hurt the soul. But now he's reversing it. If however, change in the topic, if you think that the soul or the symptoms of life is always born and dies forever, you still have no reason to lament, O mighty arm. So this is Krishna's checkmate of Arjuna. If you think that the soul is eternal, then you should fight and do your duty. And if you think that there is no soul, that just life is just a symptom of the body and is just composed of chemicals, then what's the problem? Then what are you loving? You say you don't want to kill them, but there's nothing to kill because it's just a bunch of chemicals and there's no soul. So what's the problem? So therefore you should still do your duty and fight. You have no reason to lament because there is nothing being killed, because there is nothing eternal. There's no soul. It's just chemicals. Then do your duty and fight. If you believe in the soul, you should fight because there's nothing to kill. And if you don't believe in the soul, you should still fight because there's nothing to kill. Checkmate. You think by you're not fighting that you're going to be able to stop their death? More illusion, Arjuna. Again and again, Krishna is pummeling Arjuna with logic and defeating his so many arguments that he presented. For one who has taken his birth is sure to die. And after death, one is sure to take birth again. Therefore, in the unavoidable discharge of your duty, you should not lament. And the same point is over here. All created beings are unmanifest in their beginning, manifest in their interim state, and unmanifest again when annihilated. So what need is there for lamentation? So this verse is very interesting. It takes both sides. Because Krishna has just explained that Arjuna should fight from the point of view of the eternal soul, and the material body is temporary, and he's also explained that if there is no soul and just material body, you should also fight. So here, whether you believe in the soul or you don't believe in the soul, both of them, the material bodies are unmanifested before. At one time, they didn't exist. They're here for some time, and unmanifested again later. They will all be annihilated. Therefore, what need is there for lamentation? So do your duty and fight. Either you have knowledge of the soul, or you don't have knowledge of the soul, then fight. Now this verse, text 29, remember all this is jnana. And we're continuing with this jnana up to text 30, just two more verses. This next verse of 29 we call the amazing verse. Because it explains how everything is amazing. Now this verse is interesting, I'm not great at explaining it, so you'll all have to listen carefully. Now, acharyavat means amazing. Prashati means sees. Now, acharyavat in the second verse, and vadati means describing, speaking or describing. Acharyavat chainam anya shrinato means hearing about him. So some people look on the soul as amazing. That's pashati. Now let's just examine that first line. And then the second line is some people speak about him as amazing. And the third line is some hear about him as amazing. Now, each of these lines can be described in three different ways. The first way is looking. It's looking, which the first line is about looking. So, some, Prabhupada explains it as some look on the soul is amazing. So it's the person's looking that's amazing. Right? Some look on the soul is amazing. And another way this verse can be translated is some people who are amazing look on the soul. So either the amazing could refer to the people or the looking. And a third way is some look on the soul, which is amazing. The soul is amazing. So either the people who see the soul are amazing, their amazing power to look and see something spiritual is amazing, or the soul itself is amazing. So it's all amazing. And then the second line is the same way. Some vedanti or describe the soul as amazing. So it's either the people who describe the soul are amazing, or some people describe the amazing soul, or some people describe, amazingly enough, the soul. And the same thing with the third one, as Srinoti are hearing about him. Some hear about the amazing soul, and amazing people hear about the soul. And some people actually sit and stay awake and listen to about the soul. And that's amazing. And this way, that is the amazing verse. Because the soul is certainly amazing. And then, in text 30 is the summary of this section, of all the preceding verses. In what section? Section B, the jnana section. O descendant of Bharata, he who dwells in the body can never be slain. Therefore, you need not grieve for any being. So this is the summary over here. So jnana is used to dispel illusion that Arjuna had that he is the body and that he is the killer, he will be the killer and he will kill. Any questions? Mataji?
Your explanation of that verse is very interesting, but I don't really understand.
Which one?
Some look on the soul as amazing.
Okay. See, in Sanskrit is an amazing language. It's also it's amazing that you don't understand it. But it's also amazing that I'm speaking about it.
You're amazing.
See, Sanskrit always, it can be looked at in many different ways and many different interpretations can be given to one Sanskrit verse. And amazingly enough, they can all be correct. Isn't it? They can all be correct from different points of view. And they could all be true, as long as they're in agreement with the Siddhanta. So there are three ways to translate each of the three lines. Right? So one line, as Prabhupada translates it, some look on the soul is amazing. But we could also, if it's some look on the soul as amazing, so what is amazing? They're looking as amazing. But some people who are amazing look on the soul. So it's the people who are amazing. Well, some people look amazingly enough at the soul. Then that one would be the looking is amazing. And some people look on the soul as amazing. So we could either use the amazing to refer to the soul, the looking, or the person doing the looking. The subject, the verb, or the object. And all three of those translations would be correct. They're all true, and they're all legitimate translations. And the same three variations on the first verse, which describe the looking, can be applied to the second verse, which describes speaking about the soul, and also the third verse, which describes hearing about the soul. Okay? You understand it?
No.
Mataji?
No. Yes, I do, but I was just thinking that Prabhupada made it quite clear that some people, some look on the soul as amazing, but I was just wondering why it was necessary to...
Explain it? Excuse me?
Okay, I have the same.
I was just wondering why it was necessary to put out the kind of meanings on it.
Because I want you to see that the Bhagavad Gita is amazing. But that's the idea, is the Bhagavad Gita can be explained infinitely, as can the Bhagavatam. It's wonderful, it's amazing, it's transcendental sound vibration. Yeah.
Rephrase that. In other words, it seems that Srila Prabhupada's English translation indicates that it's the soul which is the amazing subject.
Yeah.
So
yes.
Why should we, you know, in other words, does some of the acharyas
yes.
talk about what you just explained? And that's why.
I don't know Sanskrit.
Right. So that's what she said. In other words, you know.
But often.
Because Srila Prabhupada said, you know, it's not just this ABC translation and we have to be very realized. And so how do we just get into looking at the Sanskrit ourselves?
You don't think
on?
That's wonderful? I think it's wonderful. How wonderful the Bhagavad Gita is, how it's true. It's amazing that someone in the material world is able to describe the soul. And why is it amazing? Because in the material world, everyone has material vision. So it's amazing that he's heard it. So his describing is amazing. And since we're so much in illusion, it's amazing that we're sitting here in Vrindavan listening to the Bhagavad Gita, which is describing the soul.
I agree with you. I'm not disagreeing.
I know. I'm just enjoying. And the soul itself is so amazing because we're describing it, but it's inconceivable. And it's invisible. And it's immutable, and yet we're able to describe it. So all of it is amazing. This you have to get used to if you want to hear some of the things that the acharyas say or to hear the Bhagavad Gita in a fluid way, that there are some variations in interpretation of it, and they're all true. Now, why did Prabhupada choose to translate it in this particular way? Why did he choose to explain in this purport from a particular angle? There are so many reasons why he did it in one way, and certainly I can't predicate his mind completely. But I also understand that there are amazing and wonderful ways to look at the Bhagavad Gita. Is that clear? Any comments or questions on this?
Not on that. Just in text 24 it says that the individual soul is all pervading.
Throughout the body.
Present everywhere.
Throughout.
Just within the body.
All pervading throughout the body, and also, not only that, that there are spirit souls everywhere. It is not that there are 28 people in this room right now, 28 souls in this room right now. There's 6 quadrillion minimum. I'm a little bit sick, so I just took one spoonful of some type of medicine, and it said that in one spoonful contains 5 billion bacteria. So I'm really overpopulated. They're everywhere. So they're all pervading. There is no place where there are not spirit souls. Even on the sun planet, there are spirit souls. In the earth, in the water, everywhere. So therefore the soul, the Mayavadis of course will interpret it another way, that the soul is all pervading, it is one. But Krishna has refuted that previously. So you have to understand this about Sanskrit if you want. You don't have to understand it, but it helps you understand. Well, you read Shankaracharya's commentary of the Bhagavad Gita, and he'll give you a completely Mayavad understanding of it. Therefore we avoid it, but it's going to be more or less the Sanskrit is correct, and his arguments are very deep. And you'll get Mayavad philosophy of it. Mahatma Gandhi out of it. Mahatma Gandhi got work out of it, or pacifism. And other people get this out of it, and other people get that of that. But therefore one has to hear it in disciplic succession, as Arjuna. Yeah.
If you have the same 24th verse, what is the meaning of unchangeable and immovable?
Immovable. Unchangeable means that the soul doesn't change, the body changes. Now what does... Prabhupada doesn't explain immovable in here. Anyone have an idea how the soul is immovable? Yeah.
He never becomes the Lord, so he stays in his
position. Yeah, that's
nice.
See, we're already writing new commentaries here. That's right. That is true. He doesn't move from his position as a servant of Krishna. That's brilliant. I like it. Achala means unflickering. It means steady. That word is also used in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Manas chanchalam astiram. So achala means unsteady. Achala means he's not flickering. So he never changes his position, and he doesn't change his body. Actually, the soul never changes. That's the point. It's achala. It's unflickering. He's not changing when the body changes, when our mind changes. It's not that the soul changes. He doesn't undergo any transformations. That's the meaning.
Do you know what the name Arjuna means?
I don't know.
Could not say that Krishna, in the second chapter, bewilders Arjuna, different statements, in order that he later approach spiritual master.
I wouldn't think so. He's just speaking the philosophy very quickly. He's not meaning to bewilder Arjuna. That comes out later, but Arjuna still doesn't understand. Therefore, as Prabhupada explains, that he explains everything in a lot more systematically. But there's no question of understanding anything without a spiritual master. Even a so-called simple verse, one simple verse, so much confusion can result if one doesn't hear in disciplic succession. Yes. Molecules, atoms. It's said in Brahma Samhita, within every atom, at least the super soul is there. So he's a soul. He's a super soul. Yeah. Last question, because it's getting late.
This section on Jnana, which of Krishna's doubts?
Arjuna's doubts.
Yeah, which of Arjuna's doubts?
Well, we'll go through them.
Would that be referring to, or is he directly attacking?
Well, the compassion, basically. Because it's basically explaining that you can't kill anyone. You're lamenting because you don't want to kill anyone. Well, you can't kill anyone. And you're lamenting because you're going to change their body, but you can't stop their bodies from changing. So your so-called compassion is based on agyan, or ignorance.
How come in one part of the Gita they say that the body is a cause of nature, and the distresses and happiness are the cause of the soul, and the soul causes happiness and distress?
Material nature. We'll explain that one later.
How come you say that? The soul can be killed, but at the same time it's the cause of happiness and distress.
Who is the doer is the question. Who actually is the cause of everything? This is a very intricate question. And if I tell you now Krishna's answer, then you probably won't come to that class. You won't need to come, so I'm going to save it. But this question, it comes up throughout in quite a few places in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 18th chapter, 5th chapter. Who is the cause, the doer? See, it's jnana. It's just jnana, basically. Just you're not your body. There's no connect. It becomes yoga when it's connected to Krishna.
Why not just call it Sankhya, like in the verse 39 of Krishna Sankhya and
Sankhya. Because jnana and Sankhya are the same. But jnana has a very specific meaning of knowledge that we are not the body. Sankhya is the process. It's a yoga very similar to jnana yoga. It's Sankhya yoga. So you might as well also get used to understanding that Jnana and Sankhya in the Bhagavad Gita are basically the same. It comes up again, I think, in the 12th chapter, too. Excuse me? Oh, let's not try to understand everything all at once. Let's take it gradually. There's 18 chapters. Be patient.